done a lot of talking today. We had one of our study series here at the center. And we've been doing a series here on Sunday nights of really focusing on the core teachings of the Buddha, which are called the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. We've been making our way slowly through these teachings and practices. The path of practice that the Buddha offered is a pragmatic one, so it's one that we can, the word is opanayako and ehipasiko, to turn inward and to see for oneself. This really was his encouragement, was to, if we want to understand the mind, we got to sit down and watch it, right? And so this really practical path of practice that holds mindfulness as its foundation, present time awareness, is staying present for our experiences so we can gain some wisdom. It's really a path of two trainings, of training attention and training intention. Whatever we pay attention to, the word for this in Pali Sanskrit is manasakara, for attention, and it means making in the mind. So whatever we pay attention to, it gets made in the mind. It gets, in neuroscience they talk about this, it gets magnified. And so being, on one hand, careful about what we tend to, at least observant and watchful of what we attend to, not judging ourselves or beating ourselves up, because this is just what the mind does. It thinks and it wanders and it, if you could put some type of mind reader device on me and see what's going on in my mind, I, would feel pretty ashamed, pretty embarrassed. I'm sure each one of us wouldn't sign up for that experiment. So not really, not to judge the mind or to try to get away from this dead end of moralism, right or wrong or good or bad or sinful or righteous, but just this sense of this is just what the mind does, and to, can I bring a little more care with what I tend to with my time, with my mind? Because it gets magnified, and then it gets magnified, and whatever we think about comes packaged with emotion and mood. Affects how we then speak and how we act. And so this is really the path of practice that the Buddha taught. On one hand, this training of attention, careful attention, and then being full of care with attention, the training of intention. How do we meet our present experience? What do we bring forward to it? When it is challenging, when there is anxiety, when there is depression, when there's loneliness, when there's grief, when there's excitement, when there's joy, what do we bring forward for that too? It's a relational practice. And so I don't know, the answer changes to these questions, but I think the questions are what the Buddha was really interested in, or are we looking at where our attention is, how it is, and what's needed when we are experiencing what we're experiencing. And so the prescription, it's a prescriptive path. The Buddha didn't offer any descriptive dogma, to follow a set of rules or to, conform to any really set of ideals, but rather it's a prescriptive path of practice to tend to parts of our life and parts of our experience with attention, with intention. It's an eightfold path of practice. It's non-linear. It's a circle. We have different entry points, which sometimes is why it's a little bit of a challenge for me to find a way in to the Dharma talk, because it's, where do we start? Well, you usually start wherever you're at. I think the first thing, the most important thing on any path, is recognizing why we're interested in doing this. I think this is a good question that all of us can ask ourselves. I know for myself, it's like, why am I here tonight? What's the interest? driving all the way out here, sitting, staring at the breath for 30 minutes with a bunch of weirdos, right? What am I doing here? You know, because there's some intention underneath that, you know? Connecting with that. So oftentimes for myself, I get so caught up in the activities of my life that, you know, I lose sight of this intention. Am I looking for ease or well-being? Am I trying to heal, trying to recover, you know, trying to awaken? What is the suffer less? That kind of was my goal in the beginning. Well, I've tried so many other things, and I know a couple of cool people that go to this group, and maybe I'll try that one too. That kind of was what brought me in. I get so caught up in the activity still to this day, you know, sometimes I forget. I forget, you know, what I'm even doing here. And so I think that the starting point for this path, this nonlinear path, is to slow down, like we did tonight, is to just pause and to take a moment to reflect, you know. And this is the first path factor. The first factor of the Eightfold Path is wise or appropriate view or understanding. So what's the view or what's the perspective? What's the way that I'm seeing my world? And if we slow down enough, we can start to look at the view. Mindfulness is weird like this because we're using the mind to observe the mind. Right? And so if you feel a little bit agitated by that idea, you're not alone. You know, to see that, you know, the way that we think or the way that we view our experience is incredibly powerful. And we're not always so aware, you know, I'm not always so aware of my view of things, how I'm seeing things. How I'm understanding things, how the mind makes meaning. It's one of the jobs of the mind. It's a meaning maker. It likes to know why, it likes to know what, it likes to know, you know, the answer. And the, you know, this view or this understanding, part in part, that the Buddha was offering, his dying words were all conditioned things, all things in this life are impermanent, right? They're arising and passing. He says, tread the path with care. Because the views change depending upon the conditions, but we think we're in the same experience. You know, this one reminds me of the last one, so we act the same way that we did the last time. And it closes us off. It creates, as the Buddha talks about, a house. There's this whole idea with mendicants, spiritual people back in the day in ancient India, of leaving the house, leaving home for homelessness. This idea of being thus gone, right? Of going forth from the home. And the home of fixed view. You know, waking up a little more, more spontaneity, more creativity. What if this, I could approach this experience with a beginner's mind? And that's liberating. I know for me, and this is something that I struggle incredibly with, but I know that when I slow down enough to reflect and look at an experience with a new pair of eyes, it frees up something. So this is the view. The view is mostly to not cling or to not fix to view, and the view is also to realize that, you know, whatever we think, whatever we speak, in whatever ways we act in the world, we inherit those habits. That, you know, the way that I see the world patterns my experience. The way that I speak and act in the world, it conditions behavior, it conditions mental attitudes and belief systems and all of this stuff. And so, you know, not that there's a right one or a good one or a wrong one, but the Buddha was mostly like, look at yours, look at how you're seeing things, and Are there other options? Can we look at this with a beginner's mind? And then he says this is the next path factor of intention, right? Training of intention. Is then, you know, what are we cultivating? What are we developing in the view? What's our intention here? And what are we bringing forward? You know, what in this experience can I let go of? One of the intentions of practice is these two sides of the same coin. One is renunciation, or this kind of letting go of, not needing anything extra practice that I'm bringing forward. You know, what's getting in the way of an easeful mind or an easeful relationship with this person right now? What's getting in the way of my well-being and happiness in this moment? So this renunciation, and then the generosity. Is that also being able to bring forward and to contribute to add something to support the present experience. Generosity to ourselves, generosity to others. You know, serving this intention, what is it that brings us out here? Is it possible that what brings us out here brought, you know, each one of us out here, and then serving that, we all want to feel better. We all want to, you know, more ease, less stress. We don't want to suffer anymore. We want to have less harm and less conflict and less depression and anxiety in our lives. And so, you know, showing up for that, that's generosity. The intentions of kindness and compassion are also a part of this factor of the path. Kindness and compassion are qualities of the heart. They're states of mind, they're attitudes. You know, okay, deep down, if I really check in, yeah, I want to be free from suffering. I want, you know, I have a desire to live. I have a desire for safety, for security. You know, all of us have that. And so can we bring that forward, and can we recognize that? Can we have a gentle, kind, and caring attitude towards our experience? This goes beyond just relationships with people. I mean also the parts of ourself, the parts of ourselves that we don't want to include. The Buddha actually directly is asking us to turn towards what Carl Jung calls the shadow side of our experience. And to let it in and to say, all right, sit down, let's have a chat. You know, what do you need? That kindness of giving space to ourselves. And the compassion of caring for, you know, movement of the heart in response to the pain in our lives. Because if we don't care for our pain, it will run our lives one way or another. That's what I found. It gets spilled out into other people, into insecurities that we project from. It's all over the place. You know, and so letting it in, even though it's painful, and realizing that, you know, I know for myself that I've felt that certain parts of me, if I really acknowledge them, they would kill me. They'd be the end of me. I would completely break down. And in a way, I did. In a way, that part of me did. You know, but what came through the other side was more space, of more confidence, more authenticity, more humility. But still, I've got my demons that I ward off on a daily basis, the ones that I don't want to include. So mindfulness is a good opportunity. We sit here, you know, with this curious mind, this beginner's mind, and then with this intention of meeting what we're experiencing. These are the two factors of the path. Wise or appropriate view or understanding, wise and appropriate intention. There's an ethical part of Buddhist practice. really, it's actually the foundation. So the if the Eightfold Path was going to start somewhere, it would start with something called sila, or ethical practice. It's very brilliant strategy, actually, and this is how we use this in psychotherapy oftentimes, too. Is it's like behavioral therapy. If you change how you behave in the world, that will in turn change your inner world, how you think and feel. Right? And so the Buddhist path is really, at its base, asking for a commitment to non-harming. That's kind of the intention that's at the forefront. And looking at, you know, what are the ways that I speak, act, and work in the world, holding this intention of non-harming at the base. One of the most impressive, in a way, ways that I've been harmed in my life is through communication, through speech. You know, I think that probably some of the most difficult things I've experienced, if I really reflect, are things that people have said to me, or things that I've said to other people. So mindfulness is it's a practice that is asked to be practiced internally, externally, in both. So it's relational. Internally, thoughts, feelings, and emotions. Externally, you know, what's happening out here in the world. And then both, this relationship with the environment, both internal and external environment. And communication is this both area. It's where we relate. You know, it's completely messy, all of this stuff is, right? It's why I think that, you know, I think that there aren't really any clear answers a lot of the time, but some of the kind of guidelines, I think, one of the parts of practicing wise communication is looking at is what I'm saying or communicating, whether it's written or verbal or nonverbal, is what I'm communicating, is it true? Is it true? Is it useful? Is it timely? Is it kind? Those are the four. Is it true? Is it useful? Is it timely? Is it kind? Again, not getting lost in what I would, which I always do, is just kind of like, okay, here's the commandment list that I've got to look out for throughout the day. Right? But just kind of looking at it, it's actually can be very inspiring to drop that and to just look at when I speak, you know, spending a day doing this, how many times do I speak something that's not really true or not useful? And not at the right time, not done in a way that's soft or gentle. And that doesn't need to be confused with niceness. Right? We can be kind and be very direct. We can be kind and ask for our needs to be met. We can be kind and tell someone that we're really frustrated with them at the same time. One of my favorite parts of this practice, wise speech, is looking at timeliness. You know, I've learned, I work for myself and I work for a lot of different places. And so I'm always trying to deal with, you know, the way that many different places do things. And so I kind of had the way I like to do things, and I have these six places I work for that do things differently. Right? And so I just get like an email out of the blue a lot of the time saying that, you know, they're changing the day I'm coming in, or they're changing the length of the group, or so on and so forth. And, you know, noticing how I have a tendency, you know, to maybe get defensive and wanting to fire back a quick email and looking at like, first of all, does this need to be said? Is it useful? And I'll write in a whole email, right? And then I'll erase the whole fucking thing. I do this all the time. And that's great, you know, and that's my, you know, I'm grateful for that. Because it used to be I just fire that shit off and get, you know, more aversiveness, and it creates this thing. So is this really useful? And, you know, what maybe is happening on the other end here? Is it the right time to actually to say this or to, you know? It's communication's a part of being held in non-harming, a part of the ethical practice of what we're, you know, this map of the Dharma. There's action, wise or appropriate action, how we act in the world. Something I really like about the Buddhist path is they have these things called training precepts. So there is kind of these five things for lay practitioners, meaning if you're not a monk. If you're a monk, you get like 250 of them. So there's always that. And they're more like commandments if you're a monk, right? But for us, we got five. And they're training precepts. I like this idea because they're kind of these areas of looking, again, at undertaking a training for our action, for our behavior. And they are to vowing to intentionally refrain from causing harm to other living beings. So it's a practice. It's a vow that we take to ourselves, but for the purpose of looking into our lives, what does it mean to harm intentionally another living being? And again, this is funny because this is the first precept, and the first one is about non-harming through action. And then there's the precept of refraining from taking that which is not freely offered to us. This has been a really, if I really look at all the ways I can translate that, something that's not freely offered, looking at even someone's time, you know, kind of inquiring, and that's something that I started to do when I really looked at this, is like, I can be really chatty with people that I'm close to, and asking them, hey, do you have a second? Like, kind of trying to see, is this time offered to me? You know, what are you doing right now? Do you have 5 minutes, 10 minutes? I want to check in about something. You're kind of asking that question. Is this offered? You know, and then, of course, the more obvious, if not taking from other people, creates a sense that these all have positive qualities. It creates a sense of trust. Right, this is one of the practices that people take if you go on a long retreat, like a meditation retreat for a week or something, is most of the time, not all the time, because it depends where you're on retreat, but a lot of the time at these retreat centers, all the doors are unlocked, right, and people have their valuables there, and there may be, you know, in some of these retreats, 70 to 100 people in them. All the doors are unlocked, people leave their stuff, their belongings in cubbies and common areas, and, you know, I know this is not how we're going to live right here, right? But it's really beautiful thing to see that when everyone actually takes this precept of non-harming to heart and takes this precept of not taking what's not freely offered, because this is the training that we go through at the beginning of the retreat, as we reflect on this, that everyone feels safe. My shit's not going to get stolen when I go and close my eyes in the meditation hall for an hour. I don't have to worry about it. That anxiety or that fear of protecting can fall away a little bit. Being wise and careful with our speech. I like to add refraining from being dishonest or manipulative in speech. And this gets really tricky. You know, some manipulation, if you are... I know some people in here practice therapy. There's a type of therapy called DBT, or dialectical behavioral therapy. And one of the things they talk about, which I really like actually, is they talk about effective communication. And they actually encourage you to be a little bit manipulative in the way that you communicate to get your needs met. Right? But it's, I feel like, a wholesome form of manipulation, validating other people and so on and so forth. Wise and careful with our sexual energy. The way that we engage with our sexuality, knowing that we are sexual beings. And the Buddha said that if there was another drive as strong, as powerful as the sexual drive, that no human beings could ever really do this work. He said, because it's just such an area of so much suffering. Not that it's bad or wrong or whatever, but just that there's so much drive there. And it's something... unfortunately, we don't actually talk about that often in groups of people. It's something that we don't really bring up, but it's something that we all have suffered around. I guarantee it. Even if it's just romantic relationships or longing or whatever it may be. So just including that part of the experience. And then being wise and careful with our consumption of things, you know, looking at how we consume, in particular intoxicants, things that cause, as is said in the precept, heedlessness. So intoxicants that can lead to heedlessness. There's a kind of a story that of a monk that was kind of like held, a bunch of robbers came to a monastery and they held this monk at gunpoint and they're like, you have to break one of these training precepts. And he was going through and he's like, well, I'm not going to intentionally kill someone, because that's the way that it's translated. I'm not going to intentionally kill someone. I don't want to steal from anyone. I don't own anything. I can't, you know, break that one's really important. I, you know, don't want to hurt someone with my speech. I don't want to break, you know, I've been celibate for so many years. I'll just get a little drunk. And then he broke all the other precepts. Right? And so just the power of it. And I like Thich Nhat Hanh is a Vietnamese Zen teacher. And he talks a lot about this precept, looking even, you know, more generally into what we consume, what we take in. You know, I know that for me, it's a struggle to, you know, when I wake up in the morning to go to my phone and just start scrolling away and reading, you know, and judging away and assassinating all the people as I scroll through. You know, and again, it's not like it's, but just kind of adjusting and seeing, you know, whatever we consume, it really creates, it contributes to our view of things, right? It goes back. These whole, all these path factors connect. And then there's speech, action, and wiser, appropriate livelihood, which I really appreciate. And I think for us in particular, for lay practitioners, for non-monastic individuals interested in Buddhist practice, this tradition was created, this blows my mind a little bit actually, it was created 2,600 years ago, pre-BC, 460 BCE, right? And the Buddha kind of had this foresight to include livelihood, or what you do for a living, as a part of the path of practice, including things for us like money. What's our relationship to money? What's our relationship to work? We spend more time working than doing anything else in this life. So what do we, you know, what's that time? And within reason, right? Because we can't always just get out of our job and go do something else. Maybe we can. Right? And that's kind of that question, is like, what are we spending our time doing? And is it contributing in some way? You know, is it causing harm on a bigger scale? And then you get into these factors of what they call, so there's the basket of wisdom, which is view and intention. There's the basket of ethical practice, which is speech, action, and livelihood. And then there's the basket of the meditative discipline of practice, which includes effort, mindfulness, and concentration. Balanced effort. This is what the Buddha talked about more than any other factor of the path, actually, is he would talk about effort. You know, because this is something that is consistently something that we're working with. You know, how much interest do I have? How much curiosity do I have? It takes effort, we all notice, just to meditate, right? This is the weird thing. I go and I teach meditation at a lot of different places to people, that a lot of people that are brand new, and I always, without fail, get at least one person to ask me if we can turn the lights off and they can lay down, and I always joke with them and tell them that's called nap time, not mindfulness meditation, right? Because it does take some effort to practice presence, to practice, you know, the mind's natural tendency is to, as the Buddha says, get caught up in this and that. It likes to just run around. That's the mind's tendency, is it likes to do that. So it takes this gentle effort, this, you know, patient effort. And then there's also the effort of staying the path. And this is something that I've noticed in my life from time to time, is that, you know, And by the path, I mean whatever reason we came out here, right? I don't mean you got to be a Buddhist and practice the path of Buddhism, but just staying in our, engaged in our, if you want to call it, spiritual practice or practice. From a Buddhist perspective, the idea here is that this life that we have here is precious, you know, that we're all subject to death, you know, that this isn't, we, the mind's delusion in some extent is that we have so much time. And we see this all the time. We hear people that lose loved ones and that, you know, the regret and the pain and the sorrow. And so this is the effort of spiritual urgency, the urgency to, you know, go ahead and make the changes that we want to make. You know, the changes that we've been thinking about for a while, just go ahead and actually to gather the support and to do that. To do that even if it means that we fail, or even if it means that we risk something, some loss, you know, to the path of practice that includes our spiritual practice, healing practice, recovery practice, whatever it is, to take the risk in that direction. Effort, mindfulness and concentration. You know, really those two we could talk for 365 days about and probably scratch the surface, but in basic terms, concentration's an interesting path factor, because one of the ways that the Buddha talks about concentration, which is what we practice tonight, this is the just kind of returning or the training of our attention to show up where we want it to show up. You know, it's kind of it's called samadhi or collectedness of awareness, and it's referred to almost as like herding cattle. So it's not a strict effort of pulling your attention back to the breath. Right, but it's kind of like a no, come on. It's kind of like babysitting a kid, right? A kid that just learns to walk. You got to keep a close eye on them and keep your hand on their back and kind of direct them. And so samadhi, this collectedness awareness, this concentration practice. You know, another way that the Buddha talks about this is he says to put aside our desire and discontent in regard to the world. So this is this intention we said at the beginning, to actually put aside, to have some space, a practice to put aside the shit for a little bit. And just to have that intention. It's going to come right back in through the door to bother you. But concentration practice, or this idea, is to see if we can have that intention. You know, and then what happens? Well, what happens is the more that we develop that ability, that this concentration, this samadhi, collectedness, awareness, it gains momentum. And the mind becomes a lot more still, you know, a lot more, the word is equanimous or balanced, a little more calm, a little more tranquil. It's not going to stay that way, or it's not the end goal of what we're shooting for, but it's a nice, an important, an essential path factor, a part of the path that enables us to then be mindful and to observe what's happening, and to gain some wisdom, to look at the shadow parts of our experience, to look at the painful things. Because if the mind's collected and still and calm, it can see parts of the mind, parts of our patterning and habits, the neuroses of the mind that ordinarily it doesn't so much like to look at. So instead of getting caught up in the mind, we're able to relate to the mind rather than react from it. And samadhi helps us do this. And last but not least, mindfulness is the direct path to awakening. You know, that's what the primary practice. Mindfulness has no opinions on what's happening. It's a type of awareness, it's a quality of present time awareness that's non-judgmental, that's kind, that's investigative. that's interested in what needs to bring for be brought forward to meet your experience. It's curious. And so, you know, all of these things kind of weave together, and this is a beautiful thing, I think, about Theravada and Buddhism, though, is that sometimes they say we worship lists, or list worshippers. Right? Because these lists, this Eightfold Path, these Four Truths, these things are practices, and they're reminders. It's kind of like something to look at. It's called the Dharma map, right? It's a map. It helps us navigate where we're going. The middle path is the path that the Buddha awoke to. It's between two extremes. And so the path, the balance of the path is, you know, best walked when we have some direction, when we have a map. So, you know, this is some reflection. We're going to move through each one of these individually in more depth over the next several weeks, but I wanted to kind of lay it out.